Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. Please join me in welcoming my co-host, a man who single-handedly hoodwinked President George W. Bush, Rick Hess.
Hey, Mike, how you doing,
babe? I'm well. How are you doing?
I'm good.
So that hoodwinked comment refers to an event that we had last week at the American Enterprise Institute,
right?
Your AEI, about a new policy review article where we argued that President Bush got left at the altar.
Oh, ooh, I love the wordplay there.
I know, except they stripped that title out of the article.
Yeah, that's a shame.
Basically, we argued that Bush, in many ways, gave away the core principles of his original No Child Left Behind proposal and ended up teaming up with Education Trust and other liberal groups and got behind a law that was more like a Great Society initiative. At this event, though, people were pushing back on the idea that George Bush got hoodwinked by Katie Haycock and other people on the left.
Right, and I mean, the point, of course he didn't get hoodwinked. This was a conscious decision. The problem is that you and I argue it was a bad conscious decision, mm-hmm. that they opted for kind of short-term political wins where you get to go around and talk about how much you love the kids and set ridiculous goals and create kind of vaguely articulated, somewhat incoherent policy proposals, mm-hmm. so that you can say we're doing something in lieu of more sensible, more well-crafted, more sensibly designed policies. And, you know, nothing hoodwinking about it. It was just that they opted for the quick and easy, mm-hmm. and we're all paying the price now.
You know, what I like in the financial sector, at least, you know, immediately we got some reaction to that bailout plan. The stock market plummeted. I mean, maybe we need a stock market for education. It would have maybe plummeted back at NCLB's mm-hmm. enactment, but we don't have that. It takes us years and years to figure this stuff out. Mm. Okay, let's get started, Christina, with Pardon the Gadfly.
Topic number one, it looks almost certain that Arne Duncan is going to have a big pot of discretionary money at his disposal thanks to the stimulus plan. Is this a good thing?
You know, Rick, this could be about $10 billion if they split the Senate and House numbers. $10 billion of discretionary money.
It's a lot of money.
So, you know, when I was in the Bush administration, I had some role over the discretionary money we had at the time, which was about $15 million. One year, I think we had up to maybe $30 million. And let me tell you, we got in all kinds of trouble with $30 million, and now we're looking at $10
billion. You know, there's a couple things going on here. One is I find it just discouraging that the grand reform strategy has now seemed to boil down to the notion that we can't actually get any sensibly crafted legislation, and we can't get any meaningful quid pro quos for all the other tens of billions that are going out the door. So the best that the reform community can hope for is to get a big slush fund, give it to the secretary, and then hope like heck that he knows what he's doing, that his heart's in the right place, and that this stuff doesn't blow up on him. This seems to me, if this is what we're down to 3 weeks into the administration, that's a pretty slender reed.
Well, and here are some of the dangers. I mean, they say they're going to do this in a transparent way. That's incredibly important. They need to be making sure these funds are given out in a competitive manner, though that's going to slow things down, which kind of cuts against the whole stimulus idea. But the concern is that even if he gives the money to good organizations or to do good things that most people would say is worthwhile, means some people aren't going to get the money and those people are going to be angry. I mean, this was the story from Reading First, mm-hmm. you know, where the Bush administration used some discretion to push money towards scientifically based reading programs while other reading programs were angry. It was a lesson in our discretionary money. We would give it to groups like the American Board for Certification of Teacher Excellence and, you know, Ed Schools and others were irate about this. And the charge was that we were giving money to our friends. It was cronyism. You know, how much of this money is going to go to new leaders for new schools when Arne's right-hand mm-hmm. man right now is John Schnur, who created that group? I mean, it's a great organization, but if it gets big bucks, you know, it's going to look a little bit fishy.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's exactly right. You know, the other part here is that, I mean, in theory, we're a nation of laws, not men. And so the fact that whether it's a fiscal bailout, just giving Geithner kind of a whole lot of money or Paulson before him a whole lot of money and saying, guys, go fix this. You know, I mean, at some point, we really start to stray away from, you know, we can talk about transparency and openness, mm-hmm. but the reality is that this is increasingly becoming hoping like heck we happen to pick the right guy, hoping like heck they know what they're doing with this money, and then hoping like heck that they can solve all these problems. That's probably not a particularly viable long-term strategy.
Okay, Christina, topic number two.
A recent Washington Post op-ed explained that teachers in Anne Arundel County, Maryland, that live a normal life expectancy can receive over $2 million in retirement earnings. Are we paying our teachers too much?
Okay, so let's admit a few things here. Anne Arundel is a wealthy suburb outside Washington, D.C. This is in Annapolis region. So this may not be completely typical for all school districts, but it is indicative that there are still huge retirement benefits out there for teachers. And this is not widely known. The article argued that we should make it more widely known. Rather than school districts saying, hey, come teach for us out of the goodness of your heart, say, hey, come teach for us. You can make a $100,000 salary eventually and get $2 million in retirement. We pay our new teachers okay, then their salaries stagnate for a while compared to other careers, and then if they hang in there for 30 years, they get this huge retirement payoff. The incentives are all wrong. I mean, people don't want to wait for that retirement payoff anymore. You end up having people that are burned out but staying in the job longer than they should. Can't we fix this? Can we get this right?
I mean, how many talented 22-year-olds that you know who are saying, you know what, I'm ready to go into a profession today because when I retire in the 2040s, I want to be confident that I'm going to have... I mean, that's just not the way that we're geared up to think and talk about these things.
Yeah, Stafford agrees she's not. That doesn't motivate her.
So, you know, so there's at least two things going on. One is nobody's actually aware of the cost of these, which is one reason that union leadership likes big benefits. You can hide them relatively easily from the larger public. Mm-hmm. You don't actually have to pay for them. So most of these promises are underfunded, which means we're putting our kids on the hook to actually pay for them for today's benefits. But the downside of that is teachers aren't often aware of just how good a deal they're actually getting. Mm-hmm. So when we're out recruiting, we don't get full use of it. Second problem is that we can talk all we want about differentiated compensation, but the reality is if a huge chunk of teacher compensation is this deferred benefit pension benefit setup, and most of this is going to be largely insensitive mm-hmm. to their current earnings, the fact is that what we're basically doing is we're rearranging a small portion of the total compensation package.
Yeah. And let me put, you know, say this more clearly. I think we are giving retirement benefits to teachers that are too generous and that we cannot afford. You know, but fixing this is very tricky because, you know, in the Social Security context, we say, well, probably the solution is to raise the retirement age, have people work longer. I'm not sure we want to say, well, now you got to work 40 years in the classroom to get your retirement payoff. If the problem is teacher burnout.
Well, in fact, it's even worse than that because most state public employee benefit systems treat public employee benefits differently than Social Security, that there's a presumed right of beneficiaries to this, whereas Social Security, there's no formal statutory right to these benefits. So it's even harder for us to change the rules on folks already in the system. So the key solution is to start changing this for folks coming in now so we can start to work our way through these challenges.
Okay, topic number three, Christina.
Some are wondering if the time has come to end Black History Month. One observer notes, quote, if Obama's election means anything, it means that African American history is American history and should be remembered and recognized every day of the year, unquote. Do you agree?
I think that's a beautiful sentiment. I've never been a big fan of the festival of, ethnic identification. I always felt, you know, shortchange that Jews didn't have our own month. I mean, we've suffered depredations. We used to be barred from institutions like Harvard and Yale, or at least, you know, had quotas put on us. My goodness, don't people deserve to know the story of what we have suffered through?
Rick, we'll give you Jewish History Month. It's just going to be in July. Is that okay?
See, this is once again.
I'm just kidding.
Oh, now, but it's always funny when it's the Jews, isn't it?
But you know, hey, Italians, we don't get a month either.
Oh, you get Columbus Day.
We do get Columbus Day.
You've taken it.
We have seized
force.
Columbus Day. That's true. We have claimed that as our own. But what, you know, so we're going to take pride in Columbus Day when the rest of the country now thinks that Columbus was this horrible person who, you know, ended up massacring the Native Americans. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure it's all such a great thing. Well, but look, the sentiment here is that let's talk about teaching American history. Why do we have to keep, you know, talking about all these different racial identities? Of course, we should be teaching about African American history throughout the year. I mean, why is it? But, you know, but that would mean getting rid of Women's History Month and mm-hmm. and Latino History Month and on and on and on.
Well, and if you try to weave them into a unified fabric, Mike, aren't you going to shortchange each distinct thread?
See, I don't think that necessarily that you have to.
Mm. Mm-hmm. But isn't it that you're likely to?
Mm. Good question.
Yeah.
Okay, that's all the time that we have. If we keep babbling on, I'm sure we'll get ourselves in trouble. But thankfully, we are rescued by Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much.
Research Minute starts now.
All right. This week, we have an interesting study from an economist that asked the question, could the number of kids with mental retardation and how our students perform on the SAT be largely due to lead exposure? Rick Nevin, the author of the study, who also works at the National Center for Healthy Housing, answers that question with a yes this month in the journal Environmental Research. He finds that mental retardation and SAT trends show a strong association with U.S. blood lead trends over 5 decades. The findings are statistically strong and backed up by previous research, but there are quite a few problems with the methods. First, the unit of the analysis is the United States, not an individual, much less a state, which means it's easier to mask other factors that may have impacted the findings. Second, the measures themselves are suspect, and this gets a little technical, but for the mental retardation variable, Nevin uses percent of students in special ed for mental retardation, but we know that definitions of SPED have drastically changed over the last 50 years and across states. As for SAT takers, Nevin controlled for some things like the number of students taking SAT prep courses, but he didn't control for economic status, which was a pretty important thing not to control for. So, bottom line, by all means, protect your kids from tainted lead, but the verdict's still out whether their mentality and SAT scores will be tainted as well.
Whew, Amber, I was about to say you've got to get a lead foot there because you're going too slow.
It was thick, I'm telling you, but hey, it was complicated to study, so that was hard for the minute, I got to tell you.
Now, loyal Gadfly Show listener Greg Topo of USA Today wrote that story up and has, I understand, gotten quite a bit of grief for it. Mm. People complaining that surely this story can't be true. Rick, what's your take on this?
You know, I haven't read the study, but just listen to Amber's quick synopsis. I mean, if the guy didn't control for family income, if we're not looking at changes in identification patterns, if we're taking mental retardation as a fixed attribute rather than recognizing that it's been policy-driven, there's enormous problems here. I wouldn't give this thing 2 cents in terms of credibility. Based on what I just heard.
It's interesting when you look at how the trends follow one another, but, you know, I think the variables and the measures have, like I tried to allude there, they've got some serious problems.
And particularly with SAT, I mean, did he control for the fact that now, of course, a lot more kids are taking SAT?
He controlled for the number of foreign language takers. So, in other words, you know, trying to get a variable in there of, you know, second language speakers and that sort of thing. And as I mentioned, he controlled for SAT prep courses, but those were the two main controls.
This is just, you know, it sounds like an interesting endeavor that's got no business.
Yeah, I mean, he works for, like I said, the National Healthy Housing. There's some advocacy something going on.
Right. It's like when these guys poll and they ask Americans, do you think we should spend more to address lead poisoning?
Yeah.
And everybody says yes. And they go, aha, see, we've proven it. Yeah, you just know that this thing's going to start getting used by some of the bigger Boulder crowd. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you just hope that people will, you know, in order to do themselves a service from not being embarrassed by wielding kind of unreliable evidence, and in order to try to minimize everybody's bad habit of using any evidence at hand, whether it's reliable or not, let's all hope that everybody really carefully vets this thing before anybody tries to use it to make a point.
I suspect that the Bigger Boulder Coalition is now going to be called the Bigger Boulder Lead-Free Coalition.
Nice.
All right, Amber, so what is the song?
The song, we're talking about high lead levels. We're saying they can be toxic, so we have Paparazzi's blonde pop favorite, Miss Britney Spears, singing Toxic. Good one,
Ooh,
huh?
That was a good
Toxic,
one.
Toxic, huh?
You got a groove on. Ooh, I like it.
Good idea.
I like it. I hope you listeners out there, you know, kind of get your groove on too.
Can we put a request in? I'd like to request.
Kind of be tied to the findings, but go ahead.
But I'm thinking this one should be easy. Brittany, kind of, oops, I did it again.
Ah.
Doesn't seem like it should be that hard to find a research tie-in.
All right, that is my task.
You're a big Britney Spears fan, aren't you?
Not huge, but there's cuts that I dig.
All right. Well, thank you, Amber.
You are welcome.
For Amber's Research Minute. Okay, Stafford, what do you have for us today? Anything Valentine's related?
I do have something Valentine's related. And
now you don't have to buy a gift for the wife.
Mm-hmm, that's right. This is a gift enough.
So in order to get ready for what I would call the biggest popularity contest of the year, We have the primordial mating ritual featuring the deadly combination of sugar and hormones that perhaps makes kids more fidgety than the last day of school. Will you get any? Will you give any? Will they be slipped into your locker, left on your desk before homeroom, or handed to you with great gusto in front of the rest of the class? Handmade or Hallmark? Mm-hmm. Gaudy or discreet? All these questions are abound this Friday. Mm-hmm. So how does one tone down the hoopla? Obviously, this is a question that schools must address. Well, schools in Morehouse Parish, Louisiana, have come up with one solution. To make Valentine's delivery, i.e. the delivery of the Valentines themselves, as complicated as possible. That, perhaps, will discourage and distract students from giving those confectionery presents, since they'll have to go to great lengths to be in the right place at the right time, to have their Valentines addressed according to specific guidelines, and drop them off in the school gym, the office, or the main hallway, where, gasp, all of your classmates can see you leave that particularly large bouquet of chocolate roses and singing hug-a-bear with the sparkly fur. God forbid that Mary Jo knows that you are crushing on her. So here's a sample of these Dedalian requirements. Students at Bastrop High must drop gifts between 7 and 11 a.m. at the northwest corner of the new gym. But Adams Elementary must leave gifts in the main office and only between 8 a.m. and 1. And no balloons, or you won't be allowed on the bus ride home. Carver Elementary has gift pickup, but not drop-off, in the main office between 8 a.m. and 1 p.m. Cherry Ridge, you have to leave the gifts in the parenting office next to the library. And if you only have one gift at Oak Hill Elementary, you can pick it up anytime. But multiple gifts mean you don't see your plunder until dismissal time. So, yeah, I gave this one a B for problem definition because I don't think that the problem here is that that kids are buying into Valentine's Day, but that Valentine's Day has been turned into this consumerist holiday by Hallmark and the card and chocolate industry.
Well, that's kind of an argument from the left there, Stephanie. Very interesting.
Brainwashing, yes. And I think that making the rules of delivery by jumping through hoops and doing backflips as you balance chocolate on your eyelids to deliver your Valentines is ridiculous, because all you're doing is drawing more attention to the holiday and making it more complicated rather than just sort of trying to mitigate the effects. Well,
which school's one where they have to do backflips?
I made that up.
That was good. That was very good. Funny.
So what are you rating it? So you gave it a B for
problem definition. I gave it a B for problem definition, and I gave it a C minus for execution.
See, I mean, I don't know. I think you're, again, being too generous here. I mean, if I'm running a school, I mean, I'm just about to say, hey, no Valentines. I'm sorry. We're just done with that. We're just not, you know, I mean, no candy at least, no flowers, no balloons, none of that stuff. You want to have some system for trading, you know, the actual cards, maybe, but...
Card trading, but
this is ridiculous.
But you're not a sweet delivery service. You're not going to enlist the office staff,
right? I mean, right.
And what if stuff gets misplaced or lost or stolen? There's all kinds of issues here, right? Because you always have that one receptionist who, you know, just out of habit is just kind of eating out of the candy dish. And what if she accidentally eats out of? You know, it could be a mess. Right.
It could be a public health disaster. Now, the other thing is that there was an article I just saw a little while ago from Ontario where the students have figured out how much paper goes into giving one another Valentines. This is an elementary school. And that if you did it, you know, within their own class, it's 900 pieces of paper, 30 kids times 30, and there you go. You know, think about the whole school district. They figured out almost 500,000 pieces of paper throughout the whole school district. So they're going green, and they're just going to pick a name out of the hat and give a Valentine to one other person. That, to me, sounds like a good
solution. Or they could do it on email.
Thank you. There you go.
In fact, you could, in order to address spam, you could have just one school-wide Valentine sent from everybody to everybody. Mm-hmm. No kids are left out. You don't create needless spam clutter. Mm-hmm. And you can kind of send out the mass Valentine and then get on with the day.
See, I think this is what should be the focus for schools on Valentine's Day, the love of learning. And that's all I have to say about that. Okay, I think we are out of time. Until next week.
I'm Rick Hess.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute's Education Gadfly Show, signing off.